This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to hear about a new documentary, Food Chains. It's the story of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and how it is winning the struggle for better conditions in the fields for farm workers, not just in Florida, but hopefully throughout the country.
We'll discuss a disappointing verdict in the case of Razmeh Odeh.
They used to say the most dangerous job in America was being black. Well, it's also being Palestinian.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Ratner, I understand that President Obama may be seeking additional war powers from Congress.
You know, Heidi, when we think about the midterm elections and the fact that the Republicans took both houses now, and everybody looks at it as, oh, this bad thing for Obama. And the New Yorker cover has this picture of Obama in the Oval Office sitting there with a huge elephant, you know, the elephant in the room, which is a very clever cover. On a key issue that affects our country and murders people and spends a lot of money, I think Obama likes the fact that the Republicans won. The key issue is war. And here's what's going on. A few weeks ago, I talked about the authorization to use military force, which was passed after 9/11, and is the authorization that allows the president, whomever that president is, to use military force to go after people who were involved in any way in 9/11. It's called the authorization to use military force. It's the AUMF. With that, the U.S. has gone after Afghanistan, used drones in Yemen, drones in Pakistan, all over the world, essentially, and used it to justify the prisoners at Guantanamo, used it to justify under Bush the torture regime, etc. So I remember comparing the authorization to use military force to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was the open-ended congressional law that allowed various presidents to essentially drive the Vietnam War up to over 500,000 troops, carpet bomb the place, go into Cambodia, Laos, etc. And that's what the AUMF is like. And it's recently come up now, again, because of the war against the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq.
ISIS.
The U.S. has been bombing them, and it recently sent in another 1,500, quote, advisors. Advisors with AK-47s, I assume, but advisors, they call them. And the question is, what's the authority? Because ISIS is apparently opposed to al-Qaeda. So how can they use the AUMF, which is about al-Qaeda and 9/11 and the Taliban and their affiliated forces, how can they use that to go after ISIS? And isn't the president carrying out an illegal war contrary to the Constitution? And also as well contrary, of course, to the UN Charter. So there's been some little storm about it, but the president continues on his merry way. And so now what came up was, well, let's give ourselves another law. And the first law that he was planning to get was in the, what they call the lame duck, which is the period we're in now before the Republicans take over both houses. Now they just control the House of Representatives, not the Senate yet. And he was just going to pass a narrow law to say we can go after ISIS. I don't know if they're really going to do that now because they realize that even for that law, once they get the Republicans into both houses, they're going to have a much easier time with that. So they want to pass something to go after ISIS as sort of an interim. And then in the new Congress, which will be Republican on both sides, our wonderful Democratic president wants to pass a broader AUMF, authorization to use military force, rolls in the old one from 2001, rolls in the new one that they might or might not get against ISIS, and makes one big one that allows the president to essentially carry out, quote, counterterrorism actions all over the world, pure and simple. Gulf of Tonkin all the way. It's pretty remarkable to see this going on, but it just demonstrates that this country has been at war since the three of us sitting here have been kids, continues to do it in whatever means it wants. So it's a moment when we're again seeing Obama, the so-called Peace Prize winner, not so-called, he actually won the Nobel Peace Prize,
hoping that he would do something to deserve it. They should take it back. But, you know, he's bombed seven Muslim countries in 6 years. It's been a continual war since I was born in the middle of the Second World War. There hasn't been a war for my entire lifetime. That's the U.S., folks.
Yep.
And so if you think about war, as Michael is saying, what would you say, 6 or 7 Muslim countries since Obama's been in 6 years? And so let's just review where we are. We have the authorization to use military force, which essentially they've been misusing to go everywhere. You have the another sort of AUMF that I didn't mention around Iraq, but that's essentially the authorization to use force initially in Iraq that that was, you know, our friend Hillary Clinton voted for and that has brought us into the worst disaster. Then you're going to have this new one against ISIS. And then in the end, once you get the Republicans into the Senate again, controlling it, you're going to have one that rolls it in and allows it to attack everything from Uruguay to Cuba to droning Ireland. So there you go. Thank you for the separation of powers, and thank you for United Nations they ignore.
Michael Ratner, you were recently in Berlin, where I understand the International Criminal Court's prosecutor's decision in the Gaza flotilla case came down. What was that verdict?
The reason I wanted to mention Berlin is because I was there for an international conference that we have at the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, and we'd invited a man named Raji Sarani, a lawyer from Gaza, to come to the conference. His group, the Palestine Committee on Human Rights, is one of the 15 or so affiliated organizations that we have across the world, particularly the Global South, that get together yearly to talk about really progressive, radical, legal issues. Raji was invited, but he couldn't make it to the meeting. And why couldn't he make it to the meeting? Because you can't get out of Gaza. He cannot get out of Gaza. He can't go through Israel. He's been tortured by Israel. He's not allowed through into Israel. His only exit is the Rafah exit from Gaza, which is into Egypt. And Egypt has blockaded that exit, torn down all the houses, etc. I mention that because, of course, the ICC decision is going to be around Gaza, whether it's blockaded, the one I'm going to talk about. But I also mention it because while I was there, I had to give a little talk, and it happened to be the 25th anniversary of the tearing down of the wall between East Berlin and West Berlin. And, of course, for many people, it was a totally joyous occasion. You know, balloons lined the whole walk, which were on these poles, and you could walk through it. And as I said in the talk, whatever we think about the tearing down of that wall and the bringing together of East and West Berlin again, or whatever people's thoughts are and joy about it, etc., we have to remember other walls, and particularly we have to remember the wall around Gaza that prevented Raji from coming here. I also said we have to remember the wall that is what I call the wall of death in the Mediterranean, which is to say thousands of refugees are leaving Africa, war-torn parts of Africa, trying to get across to Italy, Spain, other parts of Europe, and they're drowning. Thousands a year are drowning. Italy,
they're going by boat.
They're going by boat. Italy is trying to save them, but Italy doesn't have a lot of money to do it. Italy sends out whatever its Coast Guard, others to try and save the refugees, and Europe has turned its back on them. Europe will not give Italy any money for the purpose of actually saving refugees. So when I talked about the wall, I talked about, as I said, first the wall of Gaza, and secondly, the wall of death that European Union has put into the Mediterranean.
A metaphorical wall, as it were.
A metaphorical wall. Well, we called it a wall at one time when we were representing Haitian refugees, and the U.S. circled the island of Haiti, country of Haiti, with boats and wouldn't allow anybody who was fleeing the various coups to leave. We called it at that time the Berlin Floating Wall. So these walls are all over the place, and I just was not particularly happy over this incredible celebration of the 25th anniversary and the ignoring of all these other walls that I've been discussing. It was also, it's November 10th and 11th, or November 9th and 10th, rather, the wall anniversary. It's also the 76th anniversary of Kristallnacht, which is the broken glass when Hitler's goons essentially went out and crashed all the shops, Jewish shops. But, of course, you wouldn't know that mostly from being in Berlin, which was celebrating the tearing down of its wall. But that brings us, Heidi, to what your original question was. When I'm in Berlin, I see there's an International Criminal Court decision by the prosecutor. Let's back up for a second. People probably remember the attack on the Gaza flotilla, particularly the Mavi Marmara, which was one of 8 boats that was sent from Europe and other places, Turkey, to try and break the blockade that Israel had imposed on Gaza.
About 4 years ago, roughly.
Right. It took place in May of 2010. Israel has been blockading Gaza forever, essentially, but it put in a very serious naval blockade in 2009, and no boats from the Mediterranean could approach within 20 miles of what Israel called its blockade.
And what would happen? Would they be shot at if they did?
They would. I don't think anyone ever got into the 20 miles. I don't recall. We covered a boat here before that was rammed by the Israeli Navy and disabled, and then was forced to be evacuated and people taken prisoners and taken into Israel. The Gaza Flotilla was established in 2010 to try and break the blockade. It had 8 ships. One was named the Rachel Corrie for the woman who was murdered by the IDF, or the bulldozer operators, in Gaza in her protesting a house demolition. The Mavi Marmara is named after a sea. It touches Turkey, an internal sea, as I recall. And they were proceeding toward Israel, 80 miles, I think it was 60 miles, outside of the 20-mile blockade. So they were at least 80 miles away from Gaza, hadn't even gotten into the, quote, blockaded territory, when the Israeli commandos, the IDF, made a raid on those boats, and particularly on the Mavi Marmara, which was a Turkish boat. But interestingly, also, it was registered in the country of Comoros, an island, I think, it's off the coast of Africa. The boat is a Turkish ship that was registered in Comoros. And that's important because to get jurisdiction in the International Criminal Court, you need to have signed the treaty with the International Criminal Court. And neither Turkey nor the United States had signed the treaty. But the fact that the boat was registered in Comoros gave the International Criminal Court jurisdiction over the raid. People may recall the raid. Israeli commandos shimmied down ropes from helicopters onto the Mavi Marmara, and they killed 9 people. A 10th died later. There's one of the people who the center represented, who was a U.S. citizen as well as Turkish, was actually shot in the head. There's some videos of it. And ultimately, Comoros made a complaint to the International Criminal Court that what happened when Israel, the IDF, attacked this flotilla, even outside the 20-mile blockade zone, they committed war crimes in that they were attacking civilian boats, war crimes in that they were killing civilians, that they weren't obeying the principle of distinction between civilians and military, and that there was willful murder going on. So the ICC has this case. Now, we've talked about the ICC before. We know its only indictments have been of 36 Africans. Doesn't do particularly well of countries that are allied with the West or the West itself. We'd hope that this case, because it was such a clear-cut case of Israeli Defense Forces committing war crimes, might have a different result. So here I am sitting in Berlin, thinking about the 76th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the tearing down of that wall, Raji Sarani from Gaza not being able to get in, and this ICC decision comes down. And it starts off in an amazing way. The ICC prosecutor says that there's a reasonable basis for believing that war crimes were committed by the IDF in their attack on the Gaza flotilla. That's a pretty strong, remarkable statement. To come out of the prosecutor of the ICC that the IDF committed war crimes? Astonishing. The next sentence said, as part of that finding, they also found that Gaza is an occupied territory of Israel. Israel is an occupying force. That's of great significance. Because when you're an occupying force, the laws of war apply. You commit war crimes if you kill people by either civilians or intentionally targeting them or attack civilian objects.
So you were probably stunned when you read these first two sentences.
I was completely stunned. I said, oh my God, the ICC is reformed. And then, of course, the third sentence is, while we find that there was a reasonable basis that IDF committed war crimes and that Israel continues to occupy Gaza, despite its claim that in 2005 it left Gaza, we are not going to take jurisdiction and further investigate the case because the crimes were not essentially severe enough, big enough of them. There was only this one incident, and therefore we're not going to take this case.
And let me ask this. Does the ICC have a mandate, for example, to only take sort of like a class action? It has to be of a certain size procedurally?
they can take war crimes that are not of a certain size, but I think they have internal regulations that if they aren't of a certain size, their priorities are to take large-scale war crimes and not smaller ones. Now, as people have argued, that basis makes no sense for a couple of reasons. One, there's no other place in the world to get these war crimes that Israel committed looked into. Israel does like completely BS investigations. The people living in Gaza, the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, the courts have no jurisdiction over any Israelis, according to the Israelis. And the International Criminal Court is the only place to go. But in addition, to take the IDF crimes committed against the Mavi Marmara, the willful murder, a reasonable basis for war crimes, and to look at them in an isolated way and not as part of the stream of war crimes that Israel has been committing since 1948 is outrageous. It's like you say that there's an ongoing massacre in the Congo and you bring up six people, not 10 people who've been murdered, and you say, well, we can't do that because they're going to
ignoring the whole context.
Yeah, doesn't make any sense. So in some way, the decision has some strength to it. In other ways, it's a great disappointment. Israel, of course, was very angry about it, very angry that they said, what about self-defense? We were attacked when we went on the Mavi Marmara, and we're not occupying Gaza. We let it go in 2005, and the court then pointed out, well, you control its water access, its air access, its currency, every piece of goods that goes in and out of Gaza, you're an occupying power, and you say you have the right to go in there militarily whenever you want. And that is a huge ruling. The court said, as most of the world recognizes, and we do, Israel is occupying Gaza.
Michael, if people want to read this decision, is it available online?
You go to the International Criminal Court. Came down the 6th of November, 2014. It's called The Situation on Registered Vessels of Comoros, Greece, and Cambodia, who all were registered vessels in this. And you can get the decision. It's quite clear and quite interesting. A last point I want to make about it has to do with the legality of the blockade. Israel has argued that it was a legal blockade, and therefore different sets of rules applied to it. The court said it doesn't make any difference, that either way, whether it's legal or not legal, there's war crimes, a reasonable basis for believing war crimes were committed. And it, of course, gave a very strong argument why this might be an illegal blockade.
Michael, did the court, and we're talking the prosecutors here, list any other possible venues the individuals who brought this complaint could go to?
No, it did not. There is proceedings going on in Turkey, but of course, Turkey has no ability to enforce it. Domestic court decisions against the IDF. So while, my office, the center, really, we condemn the decision for being basically chicken by not going after it and for legal reasoning that they shouldn't have done to dismiss it. It is, in the continuous way in which we're slowly taking apart, the illegalities of Israel and the IDF, this is another nail in hopefully what will be the end of Israeli severe deprivations of human rights and violations of international law.
It chips away at the mainstream narrative.
It certainly does. It certainly does. You didn't see any of this coverage in the New York Times about this decision. The documentary film Food Chains opens nationwide in the United States on November 21st. The film brings you into the world of a Florida farm worker-led effort to hold responsible the $4 trillion global supermarket industry. The CIW, Coalition of Immokalee Workers, is doing so through the Fair Food Program. That's the program which partners growers, retailers, and farm workers to improve working conditions for farm laborers in the United States. For years, farm workers endured abuse, wage theft, and have been beaten and sexually harassed. CIW has changed that. Food Chains producers include Eva Longaria and Eric Schlosser. To find out about screening times and activities you can take, go to the website ciw-online.org or our own website at Law and Disorder. Today we're joined by a farm worker organizer with CIW, Gerardo Reyes Chavez. Gerardo, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
You're in New York today for this interview because of an opening of an important film called Food Chains and because of Wendy's protests. Can you first tell us a little bit about this movie Food Chains that's opening on November 21 across the country?
Yeah, Food Chains, it's a film that's been on the works for a while. The filmmakers came to Immokalee because they heard about the conditions that we faced, and they heard about the campaign for fair food that we launched in Immokalee many years ago to address the sub-poverty wages and the working conditions that have existed for too long, abusive conditions in the fields, in the tomato industry. Through that campaign, the filmmakers decided to join us and to know, to learn, as many people have, and realize that there was a beautiful story to tell, a story of a struggle where the farm workers were the ones leading the way to transform the tomato industry, which is one of the most powerful industries in the country in terms of food production. It's the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is the main story of the movie, Food Chains. And so that movie is going to show in movie theaters across the country, including here in New York. There are some cities that are organizing with us different activities in D.C., in L.A., San Francisco, Denver, Tampa, Orlando, Miami, just to mention a few cities. Here in New York, there's a collaboration that we're going to have with some organizations locally that are participating in putting together a Wendy's protest. So we want to make sure that people know that protest is going to be on Saturday, November 22nd at 3 p.m. And that's going to be on a little march on 20 East 14th Street. That's where we are going to meet. And we're going to march towards Broadway, 650 Broadway, where there's a Wendy's located.
Now, Wendy's is part of a national campaign that CIW is involved in. Is that right?
Yeah, Wendy's in nationwide is one of the main focuses. There's also other brands of supermarkets that we have tried to get in communication with, but the main campaign is Wendy's. And in the South, we're also pressuring the supermarket of Publix.
Tell us a little bit about the work that people do in Florida. I mean, you've been there for how many years now?
Close to 15 years.
15 years. And you began as a person in the fields, is that right?
Well, I still work in the fields during the season. I do both things, work in the fields and organize.
How did conditions start and how have they changed?
Well, the change is dramatic. If you look at just a few years back, before the implementation of what we call the Fair Food Program, which is a program to deal with all the abusive conditions happening in the fields right now. The Fair Food Program was created by workers to eliminate conditions that have existed for decades, like the situations of stagnant wages, situations of sexual harassment, violence in the fields, and in the extreme situations of slavery, cases of slavery that have been prosecuted, seven until now, resulting in the freedom of more than 1,200 workers, 15 bosses going to prison. That's the extreme. And that is only possible because in the normal situation, we lived under conditions that could be described only as sweatshops in the fields. So in order to transform that is that we have been fighting first locally in Immokalee, trying to bring the tomato industry and the agricultural industry in general to have dialogue with us. And then since 2001, we started the campaign for fair food because we knew that the industry wasn't ready or willing to talk with us back then. And we needed to bring those who were directly profiting from the conditions that exist in the fields by using their incredible buying power, driving prices down to maximize their profits. So we thought that in order to be effective in transforming the entire industry, we needed all the buyers, and that's how it all started.
And then you've had some dramatic victories. I mean, people, it started slowly, but can you talk about that and the fact that, I mean, it took many years to get there, so people assume it, but it's been remarkable, actually.
Yeah, well, it all started with Taco Bell. There was a boycott that was necessary in those first years, 2001 from 2001 to 2005, the boycott was over with the first agreement ever where Taco Bell committed to pay 1 penny more per pound and to implement a code of conduct with us. At that time, the industry wasn't ready, but then we continue to push for other retail buyers to join us. So we did campaigns with McDonald's, Subway, Whole Foods. Well, Whole Foods was not really a big campaign, but Burger King and many others. In total, we have 12 corporations participating with us, including Walmart, just this last January. And through that, we were able to gather so much buying power on our side that the industry had to come on board. They came in 2011, represented under the FTG, which is the Florida Tomato Growers Exchange, and they represent about 90% of the tomato industry in the state of Florida, which as a state produces 90% of the fresh tomatoes nationwide. The transformation of that and the scope of that industry is huge. Now workers don't have to give up their morning as they used to, because before you would wake up at 4, arrive to the fields, don't have any of that time accounted for, paid for by the industry, but you were required to be there. Now the time to go to work is closer to the time in which you start. You are in control of your own time clocks in the fields, your carts. You have the right to complain without retaliation. Before, if anybody complained, would be fired on the spot or victim of violence even. Now there's, I think, more than 550, I don't remember exactly the number, 550 complaints, more or less, that have been resolved through the implementation of this program. Women that were sexually harassed for the first time have come forth, and they are doing it more and more. And the bosses who were doing that are fired. That has never happened in history. Workers have shed in the fields. We also have the right to form committees on health and safety, the right to stop if there's pesticides, extreme heat, or situations that put our lives in danger.
No, it's a remarkable set of victories. Now, is Wendy's the only fast food restaurant chain that has not come on board yet?
Yeah, I mean, we have four of the five major restaurant chains on our side. And Wendy's is basically the big holdout. So we know that ultimately it's not up to Wendy's whether they join or not. It's up to the people. So we are asking people, and that's why the protest is so important. The protests are going to be happening in many cities. But we need to just like recognize that we as people have the power, and the consumers have a lot to say to Wendy's. It's time for them to listen to this, and it's time for us workers, consumers all over the nation to join together and do it, not because people feel that workers need help, but because at the end of the day, the food on the table of every family in this nation is possible thanks to us.
Now, I know you're here in New York for organizing, and there's Coalition of Immokalee Workers, CIW people, spread out across the country, doing organizing both around Wendy's, but also around this movie that's going to come out on November 21 across the country. Tell us again about what that movie is, and then I know you're rushing off to do another interview, so we'll finish.
Well, the movie talks about the story focusing on the campaign with Publix, but it's a really good way to get to understand the basics of the campaign for fair food. It talks about what's going on in the fields. It talks about why the corporate campaign makes sense in terms of the market being the one driving prices down, putting also growers on a position that's difficult while they get more and more profit. So it talks about that. It talks also about what should be done. And at the end of those screenings, we're going to be having conversations with people. So if there's people that want to join us for the weekend of the 21st, we're going to be talking about this, answering questions and joining with everyone who's willing to do their part in transforming even more the industry that started to apply this program in Florida. We are on the brink of expansion of the protections that are happening this at this moment in the state of Florida to other states up north due to the agreement with Walmart. And we are hoping that other corporations will join. The penny a pound represents a little bit of money, but it's only a small fraction of the whole market.
Websites people can go to for information, in addition to Law and Disorder, where we'll have posted the films around the country, are www.ciw-online.org. That's ciw-online.org. Or to find out more about the film and its showing, it's foodchainsfilm.com, foodchainsfilm.com. And what kind of actions do you want people to take, Gerardo?
Well, we want people to go to Wendy's. If the Wendy's is the one closer to you, go to deliver a letter that you can print in the first website you mentioned at ciw-online.org. We want people to join us whatever we're going to have protests. There's alliances that we have in different cities, and there's Fair Food chapters. People can form their own Fair Food chapter. We can talk about that if you get in touch with us through our website. There's a way in which you can communicate directly to all of us. For people who are here in New York, I would invite everyone to join us. The premiere here, one of the most important ones of this weekend, is going to be on Saturday, November the 22nd. And it's going to be on the Quad Cinema. For those who don't know, that's located at 34 West 13th Street, and that's going to be at 1 p.m. So I hope to see all of you joining us here in New York. In other cities, there's going to be the same. San Francisco and other cities are going to be organizing different activities, marches. This campaign doesn't have a specific date in the calendar. You should feel free and encouraged to try to do something about it. Try to see the movie and do something regardless of where you are. You can do, it doesn't matter how little it seems, can affect change right away directly in the lives of the workers.
You can walk into a Wendy's and say, why haven't you joined the Fair Food campaign, right, Gerardo?
Exactly. Join the Fair Food program, Wendy's. The time is up.
Gerardo Reyes Chavez, farm worker, worker with CIW, Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Thank you for being with us on Law and Disorder, and you've had an amazing set of victories, so congratulations.
Thank you so much. And by the way, I love the name of the show.
All right. Thanks, Gerardo.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In Detroit, Palestinian activist Rasmia Odeh was found guilty of one count of unlawful procurement of naturalization. For over a year, Rasmia, her supporters, and her legal team have been battling this government prosecution, saying from the start that the immigration charge was nothing but a pretext to attack this icon of the Palestine Liberation Movement. Federal Judge Gershwin Drain made it impossible for her to put on a defense, ruling that evidence of her torture from the military in Israel was not to be admitted. We get more details on the case from her attorney, Michael Deutsch. Michael, we previously spoke to you before the trial of Rasmia Oda commenced, and now, unfortunately, we know that last Monday she was found guilty on one count of unlawful procurement of naturalization, and we wanted to be able to talk to you about what all this means. Could you give us some background to this, please?
Well, yeah, this case emanates from the FBI and U.S. Attorney in Chicago investigating the work of Arab American Action Network and other people who were doing Palestine solidarity work in the Chicago area and in the throughout the Midwest. They were organizing trips. They were doing education. They were bringing speakers here from Palestine to talk and educate people. And as a result of that work, they were targeted by the FBI. Ultimately, in September of 2010, the homes of seven activists were invaded and all their political material were taken. There was a grand jury that was convened, and 23 activists were subpoenaed. And they also sought the records of the Arab American Action Network. And one of the things that happened, and we know this from the documents that we obtained in the Oda case, is that in January of 2010, this is like 9 months before the raids and the grand jury, the U.S. attorney in Chicago sent a request to Washington to look into the records of Oda in Israel and contacted the Israeli government and set up this kind of protocol where they were asked to search all their records for anything having to do with Rasmia Oda. And after several years, the Israelis came up with these documents which showed that she had been arrested in 1969, put on trial by a military tribunal in the occupied territories. And remember, 69 was shortly after the 67 invasion and occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Found guilty, tortured, horrifically tortured, confessed, as did her co-defendant, sentenced to life in prison, put in an Israeli prison, tried to escape in 1975, caught in the tunnel trying to get out. As a result of this, they then looked at her naturalization application and saw that she had said no as to whether she had ever been arrested, convicted, or in prison. And they commenced the criminal investigation and indicted her 9 years after she had gotten her citizenship and months before the statute of limitations would have run on this type of charge. And they didn't even charge her in Chicago, which was responsible for all this. They farmed it out to Detroit, where she had filled out her application for naturalization, basically put her on trial in Detroit federal court. And of course, as your listeners might have learned, you know, we put forward a multi-level defense. One, we said that anything that was produced by the military court, military judicial system, was illegitimate, illegal. That you're tried by soldiers posing as judges. You can't see a lawyer until you confess. Confessions are systematically the result of torture, and therefore all these. The documents which purport to say that she was in prison or convicted, and she was convicted of being involved in bombings that were attributed to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. We said the court couldn't use that. And beyond that, we said that she had been horrifically tortured, and we had someone evaluate her over many days and hours, and this woman, who is an expert on torture, one of the leading experts on torture and post-traumatic stress, said that she still suffers from serious post-traumatic stress disorder, and that would have caused her, when she filled out the application, to cognitively block what had happened to her 40 years prior in Israel. And therefore, she wasn't intentionally lying. She believed that the questions that were being asked of her had to do only with the United States. Were you ever convicted in prison or arrested? They didn't say anywhere in the world or in Israel. They just said ever and wanted you to then intuit involved beyond the United States. The judge refused all our motions, all our defenses. He wouldn't let the PTSD expert testify. He wouldn't even let her testify as to her torture or her condition or her innocence. All that was blocked in motions by the government, which the court granted. And so we went to trial with basically our hands tied behind our back. He wouldn't even ask the jurors in voir dire anything about Israel-Palestine. Oh, he said that wasn't relevant and that was too far in the past. Wouldn't ask him about PTSD or innocence or torture. So predictably, we had a jury that knew nothing about the history of this case, didn't really seem interested in it in any way based on their backgrounds, and found her guilty. And that was not a big surprise given the court's pretrial rulings. But what was a shock to me was the judge locked her up pending sentencing. Basically said that she didn't have any roots in the community, despite the fact that over 100 people came from Chicago and the Midwest and sat in that courtroom. They had to have an overflow courtroom to accommodate all her supporters. And these were middle-aged Palestinian and Arab women who she had organized and worked with over the years in Chicago, helping them adjust to life in the United States and working with their families, and have done extraordinary work, unprecedented work in working with the immigrant communities in Chicago. And he said, well, that wasn't showing roots in the community. She didn't have any immediate family in Chicago because her father and brother had died, and therefore she was a flight risk. And he referred to her escape attempt in 1975 from an Israeli prison, which she admitted that she did. Why wouldn't any political prisoner try to escape, she said, and use that against her to deny her bail. And now she sits in a county jail in Port Huron, Michigan, for 5 months before the sentencing. And obviously, if the judge isn't going to grant her bail pending sentencing, he's not going to give her bail pending appeal. So that's the situation.
Michael, I think we can get a picture of this judge. Gershwin Drain is his name. But tell us a bit more about his background. Have you appeared before him before?
No. Interestingly, we had another judge before him whose name was Paul Borman, who was very tied to the Israeli government and country and organized trips there. And we moved to recuse him, and he accused us of, you know, making up things. And then ultimately, like maybe 2 or 3 weeks before trial, he, on his own motion, recused himself because he learned that one of the bombings that she was convicted of occurred in a supermarket in Tel Aviv, and his family had a financial interest in the supermarket. So he got off, and then we had this judge, Gershwin Drain, who's African-American, who at first was kind of sympathetic and supportive and actually initially said we were allowed to put on our PTSD expert and we could put in a PTSD expert defense. And then all of a sudden the government moved to reconsider. He changed his mind. He then somehow he changed his mind as to all these rulings and basically, as I said, gutted our trial.
And so, then after the verdict was read, the judge said, and I quote, "I don't normally comment on verdicts, but in this case, I will. I think it's a fair and reasonable one based on the evidence that came in." What was your reaction to that?
Well, I was surprised. I've never heard a judge comment in public about a jury verdict. He always says the jury did well, they were serious, and, you know, I accept your verdict. And maybe though he'd say that to them outside the presence of the media and the public. But for him to say that seemed to me to kind of underline his view that, you know, she was guilty and therefore we shouldn't even really have had a trial because he wasn't going to give us a real trial anyway. It was like a prelude to him deciding to lock her up immediately after the verdict. And so it was kind of, to me, an indication of what his thinking was all along in terms of this case. Now, whether or not there was any outside pressure on him or what influenced him, I can't say. But I don't believe that we ever had a chance to have a fair trial with him.
Michael Deutsch, you're at the People's Law Office in Chicago. You're a longtime leader of the National Lawyers Guild. You tried this case with three other Lawyers Guild people, Bill Goodman, Jim Fennerty, Dennis Cunningham. The Guild has been very active, as you have, in Palestine solidarity work for quite a long time. Can you give us some background? Why do you think that ODA was singled out? They really went out of their way to convict this woman. Are there other related cases in the Midwest that would indicate that there's some kind of campaign to suppress Palestine solidarity activism?
Well, we know that there's been a lot of activity on campuses of trying to suppress students who are trying to educate fellow students about what's really going on with Israel and Palestine. And there's been, we know of efforts all over the country to suppress student activity, even includes, you know, in Chicago at Loyola University and other places. And, of course, your listeners probably know that Center for Constitutional Rights has a project that Dima Khalidi is leading, who's here in Chicago, of trying to educate people and fight some of this attack on Palestinian activism. And, you know, I've been involved with other Palestinian community people who have been targeted. I represented someone, Mohammed Salah, who was accused by the government through Israel of being the world leader of Hamas. The world military leader of Hamas, the world leader, was put on trial with Abdel Halim Ashgar, who had run for the president of the PA in 2006. And they were accused of being members of a racketeering, influenced, corrupt organization, Hamas. So in other words, the U.S. government has accused Hamas of being a racketeering organization and try to convict them and give them life sentences. We're mostly trying to help people who are living under occupation, particularly in the period of the First Intifada. And, of course, luckily the jury rejected that charge and found them not guilty and found them guilty of lesser charges. And Abdel Halim Ashgar was found guilty of criminal contempt for not testifying in the grand jury and was given a sentence of 11 and a half years for not testifying, the nonviolent civil disobedient act of not testifying in the grand jury. He's still in prison. Mr. Salah did 21 months. He's back here with his family and, in fact, came to Detroit with his son in support of Rosmia O'Day.
We're speaking with Michael Deutsch, who is representing Palestinian-American Rasmi Oda, who was recently found guilty of a charge, and Michael is discussing that and putting it in the context of other Palestinians that he has represented and the repression of those Palestinians.
Yeah, and then after the Salah Ashgar case, we had this situation where the AAAN, Arab American Action Network, and all these Palestinian and North American solidarity people were subpoenaed to a grand jury, and that was an incredible attack on their work. These are people who, you know, organized trips to the Middle East, who did work bringing speakers here, who did a lot of educational work in the community, and they were all looking at possible imprisonment and another material support indictment. And in fact, the search warrants, which were used to carry out these raids of people's homes and the AAAN office, said that they were investigating material support for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And, you know, the record is clear that there has never been any type of Palestinian act of resistance or militant act in the United States. These groups that are struggling for the liberation of Palestine have basically, in the last 40 years, acted in the occupied territories and in Israel, and there's no basis for the U.S. government to criminalize their activities, which are protected by the First Amendment here in the U.S. But it's part of this very close working relationship with the security forces in Israel and the U.S. security forces.
Well, Michael, thank you for that. I mean, it's really chilling, and you know, I think you're right. I have a question going back to the ODA case. You know, I was completely shocked, as you obviously, as one of the lawyers, were when she was remanded to custody into jail afterwards. It was utterly remarkable to me. Can you give us some sense of what's going to happen now? Is she going to be deported? Is she going to do prison time? What your appeal possibilities are, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, one thing we're working on right now is the motion for the judge to reconsider revoking her bail. And, you know, we have people that are willing to put up property. You know, her bail was $3,000 when she was arrested. And, in fact, the government was willing to give her a recognizance bail, but she said, well, she would put up $3,000. They let her go home and come back the next day with the $3,000. So that was the threat or flight that she had.
You know, I won't ask you to comment on it, but I got to tell you, from hearing this story and the way the judge started and the way he has ended, praising the jury and the bail, makes you think someone got to this judge, or at least he recognized that his future as a judge going up anywhere might depend on how he handled this case. I don't know, and I'm not asking, you're one of the lawyers, so you can't say anything, but from this distance, that's what it sounds like.
So here's what will happen, you know, assuming that he doesn't reinstate her bail or give her, I mean, you know, he could put more restrictions on her and still let her have bail. I mean, this is a woman that suffers from post-traumatic stress, and we even have her doctor, who's an expert, send a letter saying, when you take someone and just put her in prison right away, there was no even a period of hours that we could, you know, adjust to it. She's going to have very serious post-traumatic stress experiences in that county jail. She's in a county jail. She's going to have to sit in there for 5 months even before she's sent. Obviously, we're going to appeal. I think we have some very good issues for appeal, but you all know that doesn't mean anything with an appellate court, a federal appellate court, particularly in a case that has this type of political background. So, you know, we have to convince the judge to let her out now and give her an appeal bond. Even after all that, if she's sentenced, she's going to go to prison, and then when she's done with her prison sentence, they're going to put her in immigration prison, and they're going to deport her or seek to deport her. That's also an iffy question because she has a Jordanian passport, but it's unclear whether it will be expired by then. It's unclear what the Jordan authorities will do. Oftentimes what they do is send someone back to the, you know, the occupied territories, particularly to the West Bank. So that's where she, you know, could ultimately wind up in back in the West Bank.
Over the course of your representing her, you grew very much in your admiration for her, but I didn't want to close without asking you about your feelings towards her, your understanding of the role she played in the Solidarity Movement in Chicago.
Yeah, well, I said to the jury in my closing argument, it's been one of the great privileges of my long legal career to represent her. She's an extraordinary woman. She's done unprecedented work here, working with the immigrant community and organizing. 600 women have been involved with her projects that she created and started. So, you know, I think she's a tremendous person and has suffered so much and has come back and created a life for herself here in Chicago over 10 years and is very much admired by everybody that's had any dealings with her. And I think it's a tragedy that the government would single her out and seek to send her away back to, you know, where she could be theoretically under the same boot that was that she suffered under, you know, 45 years ago. And, you know, we know that sometimes when they let people out in prisoner exchange, the Israelis then seek to arrest them again. Now, I don't think they would do that to a 67-year-old woman, but you never know, and she's vulnerable to be arrested in the occupied territory.
We really admire your work, and we wish you the best of luck on this appeal, and we'll be checking in with you. Keep strong.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
It's really it's such an outrageous case. It's, I mean, it's hard to believe we call this country anything to do with freedom or democracy. It's shocking.
She's in good hands, Michael. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.